Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. We're joined this week by Julia Azari. She's a political scientist at Marquette University. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Democratic primaries or the primary process in general. First, as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Liz Prezza. Liz is the managing editor for Alternet. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Joshua. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
Good.
Hanging in there. Doing okay, I guess, in Trump-adjusted terms.
Yeah.
I've been watching. We're recording this, as always, on Thursday midday, and Roger Stone's sentence was just handed down. Even as we speak, he was sentenced to 40 months in federal prison. He is asking for a new trial. The judge will rule on that before he has to actually go to prison. And this is assuming that Trump doesn't pardon him before he goes to prison.
Yeah, I feel like we're setting the stage pretty nicely for a Trump pardon on this.
I mean, it's maddening to know that that's where this ends, right? Because, I mean, Stone is such a scumbag. And you know, I say this all the time, impunity breeds lawlessness. And, you know, Trump has been on this spate of just pardoning and commuting the sentences of people, corrupt and well-connected individuals, which is exactly what Roger Stone is. And that's where it's going to end. And, you know, like I've heard people say, oh, he doesn't want to pardon Roger Stone because then he will not have Fifth Amendment rights. Right. So the theory behind that, then Congress could call him to testify, could subpoena him. And he's not a member of the administration. There's no credible claim
of privilege.
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have his Fifth Amendment rights to refuse to answer questions. And I think that just misses like who we're dealing with here, because Roger Stone, first of all, he will have just been pardoned. So again, impunity. Mm-hmm. And he would just make a mockery of the whole thing. He would, you know, lie and make it into a circus. And then what's going to happen? Like what would happen? Would Barr's Department of Justice pursue obstruction of Congress charges? Like that doesn't seem realistic, right?
Right.
And in the end, he would just end up, you know, fundraising off of it. He'd just go and hit up those sucker wing nuts, the angry old white people who donate to all of these, you know, grifters, and say, look, I'm being persecuted and it's terrible. And
it's such a joke. It really is
a joke.
Well, also, you know, you have like people who are trying to defend Roger Stone. Like he's old and he's poor and he just like doesn't deserve to go to jail for the crimes he committed. And it's like, what, like these people do deserve to go to jail. You do deserve punishment for crimes. What world are we living in?
Yeah. I mean, it really is the, you know, that dichotomy in the justice system, because nobody ever says that about a black kid. Like, oh, the process is punishment enough. No, the process isn't punishment enough. And look, you know, we have an over-incarceration problem.
Totally.
I actually think it was okay to let Rod Blagojevich out after, I think he served four years.
Of an
8 year sentence, something like that. I don't remember exactly.
I thought it was 8 years.
Or maybe he served 8 years of a 12-year sentence. Okay.
12 to 14.
So he served 8 years in prison. Mm-hmm. That seems a sufficient punishment. Although I will say this with Rod, the thing that is a little maddening with that scenario is that he is completely unrepentant, and you're supposed to at least like acknowledge that you committed crimes before you get a pardon. And he says, you know, it was all this prosecutors run amok and he takes no responsibility for committing really flagrant crimes. Right.
I mean, like,
that guy was corrupt as fuck. But speaking of terrible people, Trump, this is a personal thing. Trump, he's named Richard Grenell he was the ambassador to Germany, and he's mm-hmm. been now named the acting director of national intelligence. And the thing that is amazing about this is that I had to block this guy on Twitter a few years ago because he was such really? An asshole. Yeah.
Wow.
So for a while I was like, okay, there's an ambassador to a important ally of ours is someone I had to block on Twitter. And now
wow.
director of national intelligence. And this is a Trump like psychophant in the biggest mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. He's been, I mean, the Germans, first of all, freaked out because he kept trying to meddle in Germany's internal politics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been trying to create this network of far right wing nuts in Europe, basically meddling in all of these countries' internal domestic affairs, domestic politics, and
yeah.
just beclowning himself. And now he's the director of national Jeez. Intelligence, while Trump, meanwhile, continues to purge everybody from the intelligence community who had anything to do with investigating his associates. So
right.
it's all very ugly. And let me tell you something, the terrible people, like the worst people in this country, like right now, they're winning objectively.
Well, yeah, they're all in power and they're all going to stay in power. It seems like,
yeah.
What do you think of the debate last night?
I kind of enjoyed the debate actually. Uh-huh. Like I was glad of, you know, there comes a point in every election cycle, you know, they start being like, oh, we're all like on the same team. And then there comes a point when people start voting and delegates start being allocated and they're like, rawr! Like they just take off their gloves and start pummeling each other.
Yeah.
And that's what that was. You know, I am full disclosure. I'm supporting Liz Warren.
That's good. She killed it last night.
She eviscerated.
Yeah. She was a rock star.
Mike Bloomberg. She really was. And I thought, you know, when I was watching it, I tweeted out, oh, this is gonna blow back on her because she's a woman. Women can't get angry, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Women can't, like, attack somebody. But I have to say, she has been getting credit for the most part. There have been a few of those pieces I've seen sure. this morning, like, oh, she was overly aggressive, which is something you don't hear about men. But for the most part, she has been getting a lot of credit for going out there and just bitch slapping
Bloomberg. Yeah, and also overly aggressive, like to Mike Bloomberg. I'm sorry, the DNC literally changed the rules of the debate to allow him on stage last night. Like, I don't think that there's any level of vitriol that could really really compare.
Yes,
for Mike Bloomberg.
You're, for what he deserves, honestly. I mean, it was a perfect foil. He is a perfect foil.
God, yeah.
And he was
helping him blatantly buy his way into the Democratic primary is insane to me.
And he's, you know, he's arrogant. He's so mm-hmm. arrogant. And mm-hmm. you just, I mean, I mean, I have kind of a visceral dislike of him because I'm a New Yorker and I remember mm-hmm. him mm-hmm. being mayor. But I do also have to keep in mind that experience, because when he was mayor, people like me and you really loathed him and thought he was the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And he remained broadly popular throughout his three terms. So there is a disconnect. He appeals to, you know, less engaged voters in a way that those of us who are political junkies may not fully understand. Like, there is something.
Name recognition for one, you know?
Yeah. Really high name recognition, of course. And I wrote a piece for Alternet yesterday, mm-hmm. kind of saying, well, I'm throwing a little cold water on this idea that there's this huge Bloomberg momentum. And my argument was pretty straightforward. These polls, they push leaners, right? So if you say, oh, I don't know who I'm backing, mm-hmm. and a lot of people have not made up their minds yet, a lot of primary voters have not made up their minds, mm-hmm. pollsters say, well, if you had to choose somebody.
Right.
And basically, my sense is that $400 million worth of attack ads against Trump will get you a hearing, right? So people mm-hmm. are like, open to hearing about him. They know his name. They see these ads. They're like, yeah, I like that guy who keeps running those ads attacking Trump. But that's not, it's not real firm support. It's soft support. And soft support based on electability. And that's a double-edged sword because, you know, Democratic primary voters, obviously, and it's so consistent from poll to poll, they want to beat Trump. They don't give a shit about, you know, these internal, intra, you know, Democratic bickering. They want to beat Trump. That's their priority. Right. But it's a double-edged sword because that's not a true allegiance. When someone is like, oh, I like him because he can beat Trump, then if and when that person starts to look not as so electable, right, their support evaporates. It's like, boof, it's not, it's not fixed. It's not fixed. There's no real allegiance. So I think Bloomberg is a pundit's fantasy, and we'll know soon. I mean, you know, it's important to keep in mind that as of this recording, let's see, 65 delegates have been awarded, right, out of 3,900, whatever. And we're just at the beginning, and people act as if Bloomberg has been in these primaries. He hasn't. I mean, nobody's voted for him yet. So we'll see in the next couple of weeks. He's, of course, put all of his eggs in Super Tuesday state.
So yeah.
March 3rd.
Just want to say pundits really do love him. I was watching Fox News the other day, and Judith Miller was on, like, hyping a Bloomberg presidency. Ugh. And I was like, this is the worst case scenario.
Yeah, that's
first painful. Of all, why is Judith Miller, like, still able to opine on politics at all? Like, why doesn't she just have to sit in a room and think about what she did?
What she's done. Yeah. Life? She absolutely shouldn't do that.
Yeah, she's on talking about Bloomberg, and I want to say Harris Faulkner was like, oh, it sounds like you really like him. And she was like, I do. I was like, these people need to be fired. Yeah. They need to get off TV.
Off of the TV.
Oh, yeah. God, it's awful.
Yeah, really... no, you're so right. She should be in a room thinking about
It's ridiculous.
That's absolutely correct. And just wanted to follow up Warren. So after throttling Bloomberg yesterday, she runs a full page ad in Sheldon Adelson's own newspaper. Basically, it's a full page ad, and it lays out how much he would have to pay in taxes under her billionaire's tax.
That's awesome.
$2.3 billion.
How much Adelson would have to pay?
Yeah,
Sheldon Adelson. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
That's a baller move.
I mean, one thing that I must say is the weird, like, animosity between Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. I don't really understand what's going on with that. Like, they hate each other. I mean, it just seems like they just despise each other.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they did not put a glove on Bloomberg or Bernie, or they just, but they like just went after each other. And they're both like, I don't know, is Midwest nice even a thing? These people are vicious, man.
They're competing for the same voters, maybe. I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense to me.
I guess. I mean, they have a similar pitch, right? Like, they're like,
vanilla. That's their pitch.
Yeah, it's vanilla, vanilla or mayonnaise, right? All right. Well, with that, we should probably move on with the show. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Julia Azari. Stay tuned. You got something to say. Drives me insane. Welcome back to We've Got Issues. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Julia Azari. Julia is a political scientist at Marquette University and a frequent contributor to 538. She's also in some hot water right now for an opinion piece she wrote for the Washington Post this week. Professor Azari, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. Julia's piece is at the Washington Post website. Listeners can check it out. It's currently headlined, "It's Time to Switch Preference Primaries." And as of this recording, Fox News has a piece up that reads, the headline reads, and I quote, "Washington Post slammed, changes headline after op-ed calls for elites to have bigger say in choosing the president." And there are similar outrage stories at Breitbart, The Daily Caller, etc. You have really kicked a hornet's nest, or at least the headline did. And I think every writer knows what it's like to get a bunch of grief for a headline you didn't write. So why do you hate America and puppies and democracy?
I hate all those things. So this has been an interesting sort of trip, because I realize in retrospect, if I had known that I was going to tick off a bunch of people on the left and then a bunch of people on the right, that I would have written something more incendiary. The piece actually reads kind of like, you know, a short little piece you might have in a parties class. And it's very much in the mainstream of political science opinion, which is that the party presidential nomination process needs to be reined in and reformed a little bit. And I would actually place myself to the, I guess, the left or whatever of mainstream opinion among political scientists about this, in that I don't actually think we should go back into smoke-filled rooms. I think that system was really bad for a lot of people. But I also think that the main problems with our current process is, like, it's either, it vacillates between, like, oh my God, it's chaos.
Yes.
There's too many people. And we, right now, you know, what happens if the candidates go into the convention and no one has a majority of the delegates? Or, and I remember this distinctly because I was a pretty young, pretty new voter in 2004. And I remember, like, kind of waking up and the Iowa caucuses had anointed John Kerry as the presidential nominee. And I should also say, I'm not really someone who falls in love with candidates, that I didn't feel strongly about any of the other candidates. But I did sort of feel like there's a lot of people in this country who don't live in Iowa. And so, you know, those are not good alternatives. And so I was trying to think, given these many different bad alternatives for how we narrow down the choice for president, what could we do to find a kind of midpoint? And how would this require us to think differently about the primary? And my main point is that it's not the general. So thinking about it in terms of who wins, instead of a kind of strategic collective decision where different people have different roles to play, that's kind of counterproductive. So it's a very political science-y, very dull piece, in which I ultimately advocated for some kind of preference primary. And I'll explain exactly why I structured this suggestion as I did. My idea was that this primary would be, like, as primaries actually were prior to the 1960s, many of them are sort of advisory. And in this primary, voters would have a chance to express their views about a variety of things. So they could pick a first choice nominee, they could pick a second and third choice nominee. And also, in a perfect world, I feel like this would sort of replace some of the public opinion polls or supplement it by laying out, you know, an opportunity for voters to say what they felt about a variety of issues, to weigh in on their priorities, to say, maybe have a question, where have you been disappointed with the party in the past? And really have a kind of extensive, publicly known set of advisory opinions that then would instruct locally elected delegates to make the final nomination decision. So when I talk about party elites, I think elites is sort of a crappy word and people really hate it. But what I mean is sort of like your alderman,
right,
or your state rep.
Right.
And people who, if they want to go do this great, you know, honor and responsibility again of being part of the presidential selection, they're going to pay attention to what their constituents think. And do we have a perfect way of holding people responsible, holding people accountable to the preferences of others? We don't. This problem pervades all levels of government. But I think that, you know, what I was trying to do again is to kind of offer a halfway point between an elite driven process. And not that I think a voter driven process is intrinsically bad, but the sort of chaos involved in a voter driven process and the ways in which I think that this process really doesn't enfranchise a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give them a meaningful say.
And I should note that in the piece, you say, look, this can be paired with a traditional primary. So you can have people go and weigh in on primaries. And for example, this advisory system could kick in the second round of voting, for example. There's some potential for a hybrid here. I think that the response was interesting. And I don't mean the vile shit people were sending you, but it strikes me as interesting that, you know, the idea that primaries should be a strictly democratic practice, as you mentioned, that's pretty new, and it's become really deeply embedded in people's expectations over just a few short decades. Maybe we're just destined to have the pendulum kind of swing back and forth between too much party control and too much, you know, popular control. I don't know. But I wonder why you prefer this somewhat complicated approach over other potential reforms, like, for example, ranked choice voting, where people list their preferences in, you know, their first and second and third choices and so on. Or regional primaries so that these little white bread states that are front loaded don't have so much influence. Like, there's a bunch of other ideas out there.
Yeah. So I started thinking about this, and this was sort of like my opportunity to express, you know, what this would look like in a perfect world for me. And there's a couple, I'm going to give you a couple of like kind of fuzzy answers to that question. One of the answers is that I like the regional primary idea is probably like the simplest way to reform the system as it is. What worries me is that it's still in this mindset that the primary is a first round general election. If we're going to do that, we might as well just have runoffs. And I think some of the same people that are concerned about representation in the primary might also be concerned about, you know, the permanent campaign. We're always in a campaign. No one's ever governing. The campaigns have stretched out so long that there's never any moment where people in office are actually doing things that the voters could then like hold them accountable for. And the other thing, and it's very expensive, right? So if you're upset about money in politics, this is not the only fix. Obviously, there's a lot of things that could be potentially done about money in politics, but elections are expensive. So I think the regional primary, like the regional primary addresses some of the immediate issues of the kind of Iowa and New Hampshire problem. but it also potentially gives us, it's a somewhat more stable system, but it's still a little unstable in the sense that as you choose delegates in this sequential system, you never quite know when the votes are going to stop mattering. And this is something that has sort of plagued me as an observer of primaries for a long time.
What do you mean by that? You mean, yeah. So by the time you get to state X, it's already someone's amassed such it's a over. Delegate lead that it's done. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Or everyone's dropped out because of informal pressure. Right.
Or they run out of money.
You know. Yeah. So any of these things. Right. So like, I think some of it is like, let's stabilize the process. Thinking about RCV, so I obviously am sensitive to a lot of the arguments about this. And that's sort of, I mean, one of the elements of what I argued for was kind of like, you know, a really important part of this process that we're not getting a whole lot of stable information about right now is like, who are people's second choices? But then it just occurred to me that if we're going to ask people for more information, then like, let's make a thing of it and actually ask people why. Right. Ask people in the party where they stand. And I came to this based on both my scholarly research and my experience as a person in the world in this very complex primary that this Democratic primary that, you know, is an academic. Most of my friends are voting in the Democratic primary. So the less academic part is that I keep hearing people like kind of articulate different types of reasoning. You also hear this from folks on the news, but I hear this from my friends who are, you know, primarily very politically engaged professional social scientists. And their reasons for voting and the way they translate their priorities or their reasons into a candidate is like, is just completely idiosyncratic.
Yes.
Right. It makes no kind of clear objective sense. And that's fine. I don't think that's a problem, but I think given that people, you know, people are smart. People know what's important to them. And that's true of people in all stations of life, I think, and all different occupations and levels of formal education. They know what's important to them. They may not know who the candidates are. They may not have watched the debates, but they know what's important to them. So why not fucking ask them, you know, why not their party ask them to weigh in officially? And so you might have a sense of, well, you know, people really are drawn to Joe Biden, but it turns out actually they're closer to Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren on issue X, but not on issue Y. Now, how do you turn that into a ticket? Well, that's where I think you lock a bunch of people whose only job it is to figure this shit out into a room until they come up with something that they think their voters will go for. And that, you know, they think that they're will help them win in the general. And I've studied election interpretation. My first book is on mandate claiming. And it seems to me that when we go to the polls, you cast a ballot, you have your own idiosyncratic reasons. And then that ignorance that we all collectively have about what everyone else is thinking is right there for elites to manipulate.
Right. So, I mean, I guess the obvious objection or the obvious problem here is you lock these people into a room and they have relationships with the candidates. And, you know, you were saying that it's difficult to hold representatives accountable. It's difficult to do that when you're talking about, you know, people winning elections and then governing. This is even a more obscure process in the sense that, you know, there's low participation. People may have very strong feelings about, you know, their health care, et cetera, et cetera. They may not be that familiar with the candidates. And the other problem that it strikes me is that, and I see this all the time, you know, the conventional wisdom, people really adhere to conventional wisdom. And it you know, if you look at the problem that I think progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren face, it's not so much the perfidy of the establishment as the widespread belief that they will pay a massive electoral penalty and lose, right? So it seems problematic, but the basic point is so important for people to understand that this process is kind of it's a patched together process based on, you know, this state wants to go first and that state wants to be special and pass grievances from other primaries, as opposed to, okay, how do we set ourselves up to win the general election?
Right. So I think that there are obviously problems with that. Like I said, there's really no concrete fix to the problem of representation. And maybe it does end up being really hard to hold people accountable. But I do think that it would be, So once again, we have a situation where I think that right now in the primary where we're at, given we have some polling data about, obviously about issue attitudes, we have some polling data about parties. This actually came up in the debate last night on February 19th, where one of the moderators asked Bernie Sanders about a poll showing that socialism was unpopular, and Bernie said, "Was I winning the debate, or winning that poll?" And it sounds like he was. So, okay, so we have that kind of information, and again, this is ripe. Our collective ignorance about what's going on in each other's minds that we all face as humans in all different kinds of contexts is ripe again for elite manipulation. And I see this if you are a person who is really invested in either Warren or Sanders. You're really invested in a left moving Democratic Party, then your best weapon is to potentially be able to show more establishment members of the Democratic Party. And in particular, I think people who have the shadow of 1972 hanging over them, which seems to be common for people who have living memory of that, is that, you know, you show them actually these right. positions are quite popular. Actually, when you break down our issue positions and you take away ideological language, you take away loaded language, and you just say, what do you want policy to look like? Your best weapon is that they're popular. I don't know for sure that that's true in every case. I just know that I think that's the, you know, that is the correct way to do things, is to try and understand what people are actually thinking. And then we're never going to get rid of representational system, right? We're never going to not have some form of party representation in the nomination process. I mean, I guess we could go over to a totally plebiscitary system. I guess that's possible. But you don't hear a lot of people who spent their lives studying this.
Yeah. Or who live in California.
right. So, or I mean, you know, there's just, right. We could go over to a system like that and eliminate parties altogether. But yes. There are a lot of people who don't want to do that. So if you're going to have, elites, you have to have people who do the work of representation, who go in the room and make some kind of decision. Maybe those decisions should be informed by what people actually think. So I was thinking about platforms also. I didn't mention this in the piece, but I was on a panel. So the Democratic Convention is coming to Milwaukee, and we had a panel here on campus last week. And I was on this panel with someone who was a Republican who had been on the platform committee. And it occurred to me, one of those things that, like, you know, intellectually, but it confronts you when you're looking at someone, at how opaque yeah. that process is. Or interest groups testify, right? So there is some input into the platform, and I think you can usually watch the process. I watched it on C-SPAN in 2016 because yeah. I am cool. This is the drafting, like the preliminary round. But that process is also like entirely elite driven. And as a result, party platforms are regarded as not super meaningful, but again, they're meaningful. Interest group leaders are fighting about them. Members of the party are fighting about them. So elites are invested in this. The public has no input. So to me, this is just like, you're not going to have a perfect system where everybody has their own personal president who works directly for them. You have to reconcile yourself to you doing this collectively with other people. And so what I was trying to convey is let's do that in a way that's interesting and meaningful, but that also allows a little bit for delegation to occur in the event of a splintering. So this is all easy and fine in the years where you're like, cool, we've got a candidate who's, you know, got 70% of the delegates, 70% of the vote. This person's really popular. This also ran that got the rest of the vote, can be the VP. Good. Or Secretary of State, or, you know, something like that. Wonderful. But increasingly, it seems like that's not going to happen. You're going to have a lot of candidates. And if you don't have a majority, then you kind of need to have a situation where it's seen as legitimate and trustworthy for some bargaining right. to take place. And that's where for me, I got a little bit of pushback on the idea of, you know, what good is it to have something that's non-binding? And part of that to me is like, it kind of makes sense to normalize the role of representatives, you know, while the sun is shining. And then when it rains, when you're in a shit situation, then those representatives have a little bit of trust and legitimacy to clean up the mess, to ultimately pick somebody, because this is all happening in fucking July and the election's right. in November. So this is not, you know, framing this as right. who won. You're not winning. You're yeah. there's a process.
Yeah. No, it's a process to winnow down to someone who is supposedly is winnowed down to someone who's broadly agreeable to the party's faction, various factions. Do you find that there's some irony? I mean, one of the things that I think was part of the blowback you faced is that there's been a generalized decline in trust in institutions. And then within the Democratic, you know, base, Democratic coalition, I should say, including independents, there's, you know, this intense distrust of the party establishment out there. Do you find some irony in the fact that, you know, if you talk to political scientists like yourself, most would agree that the party establishments have never had less influence as they do now? Basically, they're at a nadir in their power. And then while that's happening, there is this widespread belief that they control the nominating processes and, you know, ram candidates down the voters' throats, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so I do. I very much think that that's a deep irony, and it plays a role in some of the work I'm doing. So I'm writing this book about weak parties and strong partisanship and the ways in which I think that polarization has exerted certain kinds of pressure on a party system that was reformed in the 70s and kind of through the early 80s to create this not so great system. And then polarization has put new pressures on that. I think some of the pressure there is that people are looking to the primary to provide them with a meaningful choice and a meaningful sense of participation that they aren't going to get in the general because they aren't going to consider voting for the other candidate.
Right.
And I think this is the symbolic importance of the presidency puts a lot of pressure on that. The other thing that I want to mention here is that you can only go so long in any conversation about nominations without mentioning the book, The Party Decides.
Yes.
Right. And so, yes, this book came out in 2008, argued that since the McGovern-Fraser reforms that created the binding primary system, that what party elites have done, and again, here we're talking about elected officials,
party actors. Yeah, much more.
If they fuck up bad enough, they, what's that?
I said it's less charged than elites, party actors.
Yeah. Right. These are people, if they fuck up, they get voted out of office, right? So they are, they come together and endorse, right? And they have every incentive to figure out which candidate, or maybe narrow it down to two candidates, will be widely acceptable, as you said, to all the different parts of the party, also has the kind of qualifications to win the general and govern a decent and reasonable way. And this, of course, was the book that took the worst, you know, took a beating in 2016 because it really doesn't allow for an instance like someone like Donald Trump. And I mean, one of the authors of the book has said, you know, this process is never going to be robust to somebody like Trump, who already has very high name recognition, has his own money. I thought one of my students last semester had one of the best interpretations of this book that I had ever seen, where he said, you know, The Party Decides was right that elites will try to coordinate, and they won't like it when there's an outsider candidate. It was wrong in that matters in the general election.
Right.
And that I thought was a very astute reading of that. So I think also partisanship has taken that pressure off of parties to pick someone who's broadly acceptable to different factions because the party label is so powerful.
Yeah.
The other thing going on in The Party Decides is that the process they describe is profoundly anti-democratic, but it's shadowing. It's like a shadow process behind a set of binding primaries. So it's a shadow vote. It's a fake vote in a lot of ways. The elites have already, in the shadows, out of view, narrowed down the process, narrowed down your choices, and then go to vote. Right. So for me, it's like, all right, let's again reconcile ourselves with the fact that elected officials exist, that party actors exist, that there are some people who do this for a living, that representation is necessary. And let's try to drag this out of the shadows a little bit and make people actually take more public stances or have more publicly available information about where the party is at instead of making those guesses. So that's sort of where I was going with that thinking.
Yeah. It's a really interesting argument. I urge listeners to check it out. Again, it's at the Washington Post website. It is the new headline. It's time to switch to preference primaries. Julia, sorry, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I really do appreciate that.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd also like to thank Liz Prezza and David Edwards, our engineer and producer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. Oh my God, I'm so close to 20,000 followers, and I've been there. I've been stuck at 19,970 for like a week. Anyway, you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
We are wanting crazy kids, doing our thing just like last weekend. Wanting crazy kids, everything is up for grabs. Oh, the times we've had.